the Subcommittee on Health Policy to order and welcome everyone. We are at that point in the session where we have to do a lot of work in the next couple of weeks to get some House bills moving, and we have two bills today that have a lot of people want to talk. We have 2 hours. We're going to do the first bill in an hour and the second bill in another hour. We're going to start off with House Bill 3269 and then do House Bill 2701. So if anyone in the 2701 crowd needs to leave and take a break, we'll start you at 4 o'clock. So with that, we'll open the public hearing on House Bill 3269. What do we have, Sandy?
Madam Chair, members of the subcommittee, we have House Bill 3269 that comes to us from Representative Greenlick at the request of the Oregon Association of Hospitals and Health Systems. The bill requires an inspection by the Department of Human Services of ambulatory surgical centers. It specifies procedures that may be performed and imposes licensing requirements onto the centers. It requires physicians referring a patient for procedures at ACS or ambulatory surgical centers to disclose financial interest and obtain informed consent. It increases the annual fee for ASC from $1,000 to $2,000. This has a subsequent referral to Ways and Means.
Thank you very much. We're going to start off with a proponent panel. We have Jane Allen Wynette, Lori McKeon. Am I getting that right?
Chairwoman Kotek and members of the committee, my name is Jane Ellen Wydance. I'm the Director of Public Policy for the Oregon Association of Hospitals and Health Systems. On behalf of the 57 hospitals that we represent across the state and our patients and the communities we serve, we appreciate the opportunity to testify before you today on House Bill 3269. We brought this bill before you because we really believe in that ambulatory surgical centers and outpatient facilities need to reach a level of safety and security and quality of care that is commensurate with the continued growth of that industry. You'll see before you a chart today that shows the growth of ambulatory surgical centers since 1995 and how that is continuous. Sorry, didn't hold it up long enough. That shows the ongoing growth of this industry and the projections up until 2011. And we believe that that ongoing growth necessitates action today on moving forward on increased regulatory oversight. The Department of Human Services informed us when we were investigating and looking at these issues that they only get out to ambulatory surgical centers every 8 to 10 years because of ongoing problems of funding and staffing that they have. And we believe that these facilities need to be inspected or they need to be accredited by a national body to make sure that they Oregonians have that safe quality oversight. We believe that patients need to have the opportunity to know the cost benefits, the pros and cons of attending an ambulatory surgical center, and that they need to know if there's a financial interest there. The bill contains three major aspects. It will specify the types of surgical services that can be delivered in an ambulatory surgical center based on time of both the surgery and the recovery time. Those standards are set by Medicare and are similar to standards in other states throughout the country. It will increase the state oversight for such facility operations through the inspections and standards that I mentioned. And it will require the physicians who provide surgical service in ambulatory surgical centers to disclose their financial interest. It also requires redundant physical plant backup systems, such as for air, filtration, water, et cetera, to protect patient safeties in case of an emergency or a power outage. We just believe that this bill would hold ambulatory surgical centers, outpatient facilities to the same level of care that we expect of Oregon's hospitals. Now, we're not saying that hospitals and ambulatory and outpatient surgical centers are exactly the same. There's obviously a difference, but Oregonians deserve that opportunity to have patient safety and quality of care wherever they're at, and this bill gets us there. Hospitals are different. Outpatient facilities are different. We are holding our hospital-owned ambulatory surgical centers to the same standards in this bill. There's not a difference. We want to raise the bar of quality in Oregon. Thank you for allowing me to testify before you today. I'd be happy to answer any questions on the written testimony or the bill itself.
Thank you. Questions? You're bringing forth the bill. Let's start with you in case there are other questions. Representative Bruce.
Thank you, Madam Chair. What's the primary of the three components, the three elements you're trying to achieve? Can you walk me through a little bit what the reasoning, maybe the motivation is behind your third element in your written testimony, which is that physicians who provide these surgical services disclose financial interests?
We believe that patients deserve to know if there is a financial interest so that they can make a determination on their own. We're not saying that there's malfeasance or any type of financial decision-making that goes into where physicians refer their patients. But we think patients have the right to make that decision if they feel safe going to an ambulatory surgical center with a financial interest or not. And actually, federal law in most care settings actually prohibits any type of self-referral to facilities that you have a business or a financial interest in. And this one is actually in federal law is a safe harbor and is allowed to still do self-referrals.
Follow up?
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. The method that you would achieve this, would you follow a federal standard? How would this be done? I mean, would it be a box check off? Dr. X has a financial interest, or do you have to state what the interest would be? It's this dollar amount. I mean, I guess two questions. Is it the same as the federal mechanism? And if it's different, how is it different? And if it's the same, how does the federal component work?
Sure.
And just to clarify, we're talking about Section 7 on page 2. That's the spot where the financial interest is.
Okay. Chairwoman Kotek, Representative Bruin, I think that we don't define specifically in law how they would have to do that. We think that that could be left up to the Department of Human Services to develop in the rulemaking process. I would not expect that we would want or think that it was necessary to actually define the level of financial interest, how much of the ownership, et cetera, but just that there is some acknowledgement of that ownership and relationship.
Other questions? So you mentioned in federal rule in terms of having to disclose or on the referral, is that Medicare rule?
Chairwoman Kotek, there is actually prohibitions in federal law for other types of care facilities. The one that comes to mind right off the top of my head is laboratory services. So if a physician actually has ownership or financial interest in a laboratory, they're precluded by federal law from referring a patient to that facility.
Thank you. Representative Gelsinger.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I see a difference between a laboratory and a surgery center in terms of the relationship that a physician might have. As a patient, I think that I might assume that my physician or my surgeon that has operating privileges at a surgery center has a financial interest in the operation of that surgery center since that's where she does her practice. Do you see that difference? Am I misunderstanding the relationship between the surgeons that operate there and the center itself?
Chairwoman Kotek and Representative Gelter, I do think that there's a difference, which is why our bill doesn't actually totally preclude or make it illegal to make that referral. It's just a consumer consent and information to the consumer so that they get to make that choice instead of someone else making that decision for them.
Just for my background and to understand better, I understand how hospital operating privileges work, that a physician in a community would have privileges at a hospital. For a surgery center, would a single physician have, a surgeon have privileges at more than one surgery center in a community, or are those surgeons typically tied to a single surgery center? And would a surgeon, if I as a patient go to a surgeon because I need something done on my knee, and I've chosen that surgeon because she has a great referral, great records from other people, wouldn't that be the only place that she could offer that service to me? Would be her surgery center?
Chairwoman Kotek, Representative Gelser, it is my understanding, and I will need to double check and make sure that I'm accurate on this because I don't want to mislead you in any way, but it is my understanding that you could be have privileges at an ambulatory surgical center and multiple different facilities within your community or area, as well as the local hospital.
Okay, thank you.
Representative Bonamici.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I want to follow up on Representative Bruin's question about the disclosure of the financial interest, because I'm just trying to envision how it would work, because you said something about not the specific amount, but it does say that the disclosure has to be orally and in writing the nature and extent of the interest at least 24 hours prior to the treatment. And so if extent of the interest doesn't mean dollar amount, what does it mean?
Chairwoman Kotek and Representative Bonamici, to me that means that you're either an owner or you have a financial interest in that facility, not the actual dollar amounts of your return on your investment or the actual percentage of that facility that you own. And I do think that we want to have someone tell them verbally, especially because verbal and written does a lot of reinforces the message so that people get it.
Thank you.
And that might be something we'll have to clarify, because
sure.
I'm not sure that's crystal clear from that writing. Dr.
McEwen.
Thank you.
Sorry. Chairwoman Kotek and members of the committee, my name is Dr. Lori McEwen. I reside at 1315 Centennial Drive, Southeast Salem, Oregon, 973012. I speak in support of HB 3269 on behalf of Salem Hospital Regional Health Services and myself. Some years ago, as you know, almost all surgical care was done in hospitals, and appropriate legislation was put in place for inspections and regulation of standards to afford the public basic protections. Since that time, health care delivery has changed, and there's been an emergence of ambulatory surgical care centers, and there's a legislative gap that needs to be filled to set appropriate and somewhat similar inspections, frequencies, and regulation of standards for the protection of the public. HB 3269 fills that gap, and I urge your support of it. I ask this of you from several points of view. As an administrator for patient safety, from my background in general surgery, from my experience leading sections, national sections of the American Medical Association, and having sat on their Council on Medical Services, and also as a mother whose daughter stopped breathing in the recovery room of a ambulatory surgical center. I doubt you'll find a more equitable witness, and I ask your support of HB 3269. Thank you for your consideration. And I'll answer any questions you may have.
Thank you, Dr. McEwen, for your testimony. Questions? Representative Brew?
Yeah, I'll follow up, and thank you for your testimony, Doctor. And this might go to either one of you. Looking at the bill and the boxes, if you will, that the bill would allow ambulatory surgical centers to operate in, the surgical boxes, if you will, I won't go through the whole bill, you know it better than I do, but it talks about, they can perform procedures as long as they're not in excess of 90 minutes or 4 hours of recovery time, things like that. My question would be broad in the sense, from what you understand, both of you understand about ambulatory surgical centers, of what they do now, of what an average surgical center does now, how much of that will be eliminated by these standards, i.e. what they do now, how much of it does fall in within this 90 minutes and 4 hours recovery, and how much of it does not, both on sort of a procedure basis and maybe on a volume dollar basis. Do you have a sense of that? Or
Chairwoman Kotek and Representative Bruin, I don't have a sense of that at this point.
Okay.
Oregon.
Okay. Can I ask then, and I'm not sure how the bill is crafted with LC, but can I ask a little bit more detail than how you got to these standards of 90 minutes and 4 hours of recovery time?
Chairwoman Kotek and Representative Bruin, what we did was we did a national search on different legislative and current statutes across the country. And then from that, we compiled that information. We looked at federal regulations and federal guidance on this. And we found a lot of similarities between some states, Pennsylvania comes to mind at the top of my head, as well as the Medicare guidance of what they're willing to pay and what they won't pay for.
Sure. And one more question. One of the things that when we talked about it yesterday, I think I briefly mentioned it, and it's sort of why I asked the question about within the given parameters. When I look at something that's having absolutely no, I'm not a doctor, I have no background to be able to establish anything, but my first reaction when I look at this is that probably certain procedures that are done in both a hospital setting and an ambulatory surgical center setting, my assumption could be wrong, but my assumption is it's probably a lower cost doing it at the ambulatory surgical center. Maybe that's why people choose it. I don't, and that may be a false assumption. Having said that, my worry is with something like this, what are we doing to drive up, if at all, healthcare costs? I mean, that's one of the biggest things that this, you know, this committee has looked at as long as we've been in session, is how do we get our arms around costs? And I guess I need some assurance that this isn't going to drive up costs, or at least get you to, I mean, if you want to comment on that, I'm not sure what if you guys have a position on that.
Chairwoman Kotak and Representative Broom, it's not our intent to drive up costs, nor do we really believe that it will.
Okay.
We think that these are safety standards and quality controls that will ensure patient safety. And that shouldn't mean that that will then drive up healthcare costs, because we're not saying don't do these surgeries. We're not saying you can't do this. What we're saying is that you have to meet a level of safety and protection that's similar, different, but similar to those standards that we hold hospitals to. And so we don't believe that it's really adding that much more burden to them. It will add a cost to the Department of Human Services, which is why we increased the licensing fee, because that's how the state of Oregon has decided that we should fund health care facility licensing and inspections in this state. So we do want the department to be able to meet this new mandate, and it was the way that we fund that here in this state.
Chair Kotak and Vice Chair Bruin, as you increase patient safety and quality, costs tend to decrease.
Okay.
Lack of complications.
Okay. Other questions? Thank you. Thank you for your testimony. Can we talk about the dash ones?
Yes, thank you. I apologize that I didn't mention those earlier, Chairwoman Kotak. The dash one amendments you see before you is actually a correction to our request on the bill. The bill specifically asks for ambulatory surgical centers to be accredited by a national accreditation body and be licensed and inspected by the Department of Human Services. That was not our intent when we drafted the legislation. Or ask for the legislation to be drafted. And so this, it basically takes it to the exactly the same standard that the hospitals face, which is joint accreditation or accreditation by a national body or inspection by the state.
Thank you for that clarification. Thank you.
Thank you.
For your testimony. I'd like to call up Grant Higginson and Brian DeLashmet.
Good afternoon. Chair Kotak, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Dr. Grant Higginson, and I am the administrator for the Office of Community Health and Health Planning, State Public Health Division, Department of Human Services, and I'm here today also in support of House Bill 3269, primarily for what it does in increasing oversight of ambulatory care centers. And I want to be clear from the start that this is not a department bill. This, as you have heard, came from the Hospital Association. I also want to be very clear that I do support the continued existence of ambulatory surgical centers. I've had procedures done there myself. I think that they have a real niche in the state of Oregon and in healthcare in general. The issues for us are primarily, number one, that in statute, ambulatory surgical centers, I believe, are very ill-defined. And number two, I think that we have very inadequate inspection of these facilities, at least from the state point of view. Ambulatory surgical centers, as you heard, fast-growing part of the healthcare industry, going from 10 centers in 1995 to 73 in 2006. The existing definition for an ambulatory surgical center is a facility that performs outpatient surgery not routinely or customarily performed in a physician's office or dentist's office and is able to meet health facility licensing requirements. We feel confident when an ambulatory surgical center comes on board that they are well-equipped and that they're doing what they're supposed to be doing. There is a health facilities review on site that is done to make sure equipment and supplies are in place and are adequate. There's also, after some procedures have been done, an on-site review of those procedures to make sure that what people say they are doing in the facility is actually what's happening. After that, however, our current cycle of inspecting these facilities is about once every 10 years, which we believe is wholly inadequate. Our concern is one around patient safety, and I cannot tell you that places are unsafe or which ones are unsafe. The point here is that we, at least from the state perspective, simply do not know the status out there in ambulatory surgical centers at the current time. Furthermore, I would point out that primarily work that's been done around physician-owned hospitals by both the federal level and the state level has raised a number of concern when there are facilities that are owned by physicians. One is conflict of interest, that I think you've heard us before. Another one is patient safety when there are inadequate standards in place. A third issue is cherry-picking potential of the most lucrative patients and procedures going to one set of facilities while the rest of the system has to pick up the others. And then also a fourth and final one is providing inadequate access to low-income patients. We think that House Bill 3269 does address a number of these issues, primarily around clarifying the scope and responsibility of services provided in ASCs, ambulatory surgical centers, also making sure that there is adequate regulatory oversight and inspections every 3 years. And we would be happy if there was that provision that it could be a national accrediting body. That's something that we already do on the hospital side of things and on the ambulance and ambulance service side as well. We think there are.
Dr. Higginson, can I ask a question about that?
So, sure.
Currently, how often does the state inspect the hospitals? And because they have national accreditation, some of that gets done by the accrediting. Could you clarify that? Because on the
certainly on the hospital side of things, a accredited hospital from the Joint Commission on the Accreditation of Healthcare Organizations is done at least every 3 years, and we accept that in lieu of our licensing certification. For those that are not JCO accredited, we do go out and do those every 3 years or less.
Thank you.
Can I follow up on that?
Representative Flores and then Representative Brown.
Thank you. I have a question in that regard, too, Dr. Higginson, is in that you state that 3 years is what the hospitals are by virtue of other certification requirements and by your those that are JCO certified. Or I'm just kind of reiterating what I understood you to say.
Chair Kotek and Representative Flores, that's correct.
Okay. Then in your testimony, your second paragraph, while each facility, and this is regard to the ambulatory surgical centers, while each facility receives a physical plant inspection and on-site survey prior to opening operations, licensing inspections are currently conducted on a 10-year cycle due to funding constraints. So that's, I'm trying to pick up on why this is a problem, if it's the problem that the system has in doing this inspection.
Chair Kotek and Representative Flores, we get the majority of our funding from for doing our inspections from the federal government, and so consequently, we do what they say needs to be done as a number one priority. For hospitals, there is a requirement that there be an inspection done every 3 years. For home health agencies, there's a requirement that they be done every 3 years, so we make sure that that happens. On the ambulatory care side, there is no such requirement, and in fact, the funding that we currently have for doing those allows us to do it about once every 10 years.
Thank you.
Representative Bruce?
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. My line of questioning was along the path that Representative Flores is going on, so I would take it the next step, and maybe that's to come in the testimony. If right now we can only afford to do it once every 10 years, what's the mechanism to getting to being able to afford it every 3 years? Is there a funding component in this bill? I haven't read the bill head to toe yet.
Chair Kotek and Representative Bruin, there is a funding component that raises the fees from $1,000 to $2,000 annually.
Okay.
Right. And this may be a good time for me to continue on with the testimony, because another thing that I wanted to say is that, you know, while we agree with the general concepts with what the bill's trying to accomplish, we see that there are problems as well. I think that the Dash 1 amendments have tried to correct some of those. But from our perspective, while this is a good step forward, we really think that, that a more comprehensive look at all facilities that are licensed by the state, including taking a look at fees to make sure that we can meet what we're trying to have as a standard of inspections once every 3 years, either by us or an accrediting body, is what we're really trying to reach. And again, this bill does not get us to that point. And with that, I'd close and be happy to answer additional questions.
Thank you. Thank you for your testimony. Brian?
For the record, Brian DeLeishman, representing the Oregon Nurses Association. Actually, I'm Martin Taylor today. Martin is in convention. And thank you.
Martin or Brian? Brian.
Thank you, Representative. Your eyesight's going a little bit.
Bald is beautiful.
Yeah, bald is beautiful. I have in front of you some testimony that Martin asked me to submit. I don't know that I'm going to go through it. You have the ability to read it. But the Oregon Nurses Association does support this bill. Over the last number of sessions, we, in fact, have attempted to spearhead some efforts around patient safety. We see this as an extension of the efforts that we've had in past sessions and would ask you to support the bill. Thank you.
Thank you. Those are great questions for the nurses?
I got his phone number. He's in Eugene.
Thank you for being here.
Thank
appreciate
you.
Your testimony. All right. With that, I'd like to move on to panel in opposition. Could we have Kathleen Cosgrove, Nancy Franson, Dennis Bell, and Dr. Bruce Johnson? And then I just wanted to say that I'd like to have, is it Lynn Stapes?
Yes.
On deck, because you traveled a distance. So, is there anyone else who's traveled more than 100 miles? Okay. Because I'm not sure we're going to get to everyone, so if you have written testimony, make sure we get it. So we will try to get through as many people as we can in the next half hour. For the record, while we're waiting for everyone to get situated, we have written testimony from submitted from Jerome Patso, Dan Leonard. I do have the written testimony of Jan Buffa and Rob Bauer. And I believe it's all in opposition. I haven't read it yet. So, Kathleen, do you want to start us off?
Sure. Good afternoon, Chair Kotek, members of the committee. I'm Kathleen Cosgrove. I'm here today representing the Ambulatory Surgery Association. And I just want to basically tell you that you are going to hear from a number of experts on ambulatory surgery. Each will talk about a different aspect of how they fit into the big picture and to try to answer some of the questions that have been raised so far. We have a couple of objectives in mind. We want to talk generally about how ambulatory surgery centers work, how they're currently regulated, and basically how they function and operate here in Oregon. But we also want to share with you some conceptual amendments that we've been talking around. And I'm just here to let you know that though we oppose the bill as it is currently written, we welcome the opportunity to work with the Hospital Association and the members of the committee to work on some amendments that we believe will strengthen the bill along the lines of patient safety and consumer choice and allow the ambulatory surgery centers to do what they do best and welcome that opportunity. So with that, I'll turn it over to the people who work in the field. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. My name is Nancy Franson, and I'm a registered nurse. I've been a registered nurse for 29 years, and I reside in Crestwell, Oregon. I'm currently the director of the Corvallis Clinic Surgery Center and also the president of the Oregon Ambulatory Surgery Associates. I come today to support the 77 ambulatory surgery centers we have in our great state. I feel that we provide a safe, cost-effective environment to provide care to our clients, and we have a high level of patient satisfaction, which we can document at every site. We are also a small business. We provide reasonable price surgical care. We contribute to local property taxes and income taxes. And we also contribute to our communities in contributions. There's many procedures that are provided by our ambulatory surgery centers. It's a broad spectrum and a lot of different types of specialties. My main concern on the limitation of time is for our cosmetic surgery patients. As you know, a cosmetic surgeon can go for 90 minutes to three hours doing a facelift. With this being limited, we're going to have some issues with that. And there are some other minor procedures that might fall under that. There's not a large amount. The majority of ours are under 90 minutes. We provide cost savings with your handouts that you received. I have a rate cost comparison that was developed by FASA, which is a Federated Ambulatory Surgery Association that is our umbrella corporation. And on it, it shows you what the Medicare, this is Medicare ASC rates are versus the hospital Medicare rate. And as an example, for a knee arthroscopy performed on a Medicare patient, it would cost $1,670 to be performed in a hospital. That same procedure in a safe environment in the ASC would cost that consumer $630. With a 20% copay, you can see the impact that that could have. Our other issue is regarding the anesthesia providers. Our anesthesia providers in most cases are not owners, but they are providing the services to our clients. They're the ones that are making the safe patient choices. They're telling us which patients we should be doing here. We're reviewing them and letting the anesthesiologist make the choice of who can actually be provided care in our centers. Thank you for this opportunity to testify, and I will take any questions.
I have a quick question, and I could ask this of anyone, but since you're first, one of the things that jumped out at me from the bill was the notion of having redundant systems.
Yes.
And I'm just wondering how common that is in the centers in the state, and I know you can't speak for everyone, but I can see that as a safety issue if places don't have redundant systems, if power goes out and you're in surgery. I'm just curious.
Yeah, during the state inspections, we are required to have a generator support. And the policy in all centers is if the electricity goes out, we finish the case in question, cancel the rest, everybody goes home. So we're not a 24-hour facility. So we take care of the patients that we have, and we do have the generator support for electricity that will take care of the emergency ventilation and the machines that we need to supply emergency care.
Thank you. And is that just for your center, or when you say when inspection, is that the initial inspection on site?
Yes, the life and safety inspection.
Okay. Which we don't do very often, but
well, they do it to make us to initially license us.
Okay.
So you have to have it to start, and then when they come back in for inspections, we have to have documentation of checking that generator. So we run it even though it's never ran. Down in California, it runs all the time, but in Oregon, you know, we don't have the power outages as often as they do in other states.
Thank you. Did I see a hand, Representative Brune?
Yeah. Thank you, Madam Chair. Two questions, two different areas. First of all, do you know, or any of the panel know, if when we're talking about, once again, these times, in the bill, once again, it's a 90-minute procedure or less and 4 hours of recovery or less, are there some sort of national or at least nationally recognized standards for certain procedures? I'm thinking of maybe an appendix removal. I mean, is that a 20, do medical schools universally recognize that as a 30-minute procedure with a one-day time? Or, I mean, where do we get these numbers? Or is there a place to get these numbers? Or is everything so unique that we can't standardize it?
it's a physician decision, depending on what he's doing on that patient. There may be a procedure that's 30 minutes long that he feels needs to stay in the hospital. That is the physician's decision to place it there. It's not ours.
Well, Madam Chair, if I can rephrase the question, maybe there are Medicare standards that say, okay, for a certain procedure, a surgical procedure, everything is going to be different depending on the person and the particular situation. But as a general rule and I'm not trying to put words in, but I'm just asking if they do this, for, once again, a surgical procedure, Medicare says this should take approximately 30 minutes or approximately 60 minutes and approximately this many hours in recovery time as a method to be able to bill.
Right.
Are those standards out there?
There's currently a Medicare list that they have developed that would put certain procedures within that 90-minute timeline.
Okay.
And we could present to you.
Okay.
And in... With that said, there is a national panel working on changing how ASCs do business, and that's with the Federated Ambulatory Surgery Association, and they're working with Medicare right now to have an exclusionary instead of inclusionary list, and they're hoping to put that out in 2008, so it's not that far away.
Follow up. Last question. Change of issue. This has to do with the doctor's or the medical provider's financial interests in a given center. And I guess the first question I would ask: do any of the state's 70 some odd ambulatory surgical centers, do they do imaging? I realize they're surgery centers. Do they do imaging? They don't do any sort of okay.
We're not licensed for imaging.
The reason I asked the question, Madam Chair, there was a fairly prominent article in the Willamette Week last summer, which I didn't read until a constituent who was a doctor sent me an email, said you need to read this, and then went on, and it talked about an occurrence that this particular gentleman saw going on, which is doctors prescribing imaging services, CAT scans, whatnot, and they had a financial interest in the actual, you know, the mm-hmm. assets. That's why I was going with that question, okay.
Thank you.
I guess there's no answer to that. Thank you.
And the same thing's true with surgical procedures.
Same thing's true with surgical procedures, though, isn't it?
I mean, if they have a financial ownership in...
Yeah, well, I mean, I guess, thank you, Mr. Representative Greenlee. I mean, you know, that was the specific example that was articulated in that Willamette Week article, but you know, should we be concerned about this? I mean, I would think that, once again, I go back to when I asked the proponent panel, you know, we should be afraid of escalating costs. This is one thing that you look at and you go, hey, if a doctor's got a financial interest and it's a coin toss about whether or not to do the whatever it is, mm-hmm. maybe you could see, I don't want to go too far, but you could sort of say, hey, maybe that person's going to say yes
the physician has to do an informed consent. They have to explain that process to the patient, and then it's the patient's choice, not the doctor's.
Okay.
I understand that, but you know, part of the informed consent is maybe knowing there's a financial interest. So, but we can
right. Yeah, I agree.
No, thank you. I'm going to move us on. I don't know. Whoever wants to go next.
Right here.
Oh, I would stay there.
I'm just going to change out.
You want to? Oh,
somebody else.
Well, no, I'm going to call someone next.
Okay.
So, yes, go ahead.
Okay, Representative Kodak and Committee Chairman. My name is Dennis Bell. I'm the administrator of a small surgery center here in Salem, Oregon. It's the River Road Surgery Center. We have two ORs in our ambulatory surgery center, and it's associated with Willamette Ear, Nose, and Throat and facial plastic surgery. It's all in the same facility. Both are owned by six ENT surgeons, one of which, Dr. Johnson, is an owner. All are board certified by the American Board of Otolaryngology, so thus they are extremely well-trained in their specialty. We also perform some limited ophthalmology and cosmetic surgery procedures. I want to tell you a little bit about our surgery center. First, we've been open since August 2000. Our facility does have a redundant generator, electrical backup system. This was required by Medicare, and it's tested weekly, and we've had to use it on a few times. Once we go down on a electrical system. The doctor makes the decision whether to continue on. Most of the time, because of the redundant system, we do finish the case, but we cancel the rest of the cases. We are neither JCO nor DSHS or the fire marshal has ever said anything about having redundant physical systems except electricity. And we've never had any problems in our 7 years with any of the remaining physical systems. We are credentialed and contracting with every possible insurance and governmental agency known to mankind, including OMAP, OHP, Medicare, and Workman's Comp. 21% of our business is Medicare and OHP OMAP billings. Thus, there's no cherry-picking of patients. We don't send some to the hospital just because of their financial classification. We also see about 5 to 10 patients per year with no expected reimbursement due to the need that the patient has for surgery. They don't have any insurance. They don't have any income. We'll see them for nothing. We're staffed by 14 excellent nurses, and this begins to lend to the quality of our organization. They are all ACLS, which is Advanced Cardiac Life Support Systems, and 5 of our recovery nurses are PALS, which is Pediatric Advanced Life Support Systems. We have a number of other support staff. We see about 1,900 patients a year, and we have an active quality improvement committee that meets quarterly to discuss patient satisfaction issues, infection rates, safety issues, complications, credentialing, and personnel issues. From these issues, recommendations are made to improve safety, patient care, and security issues. Our infection rate is very, very low. We had 5 cases last year, and we had 1 case in 2005. Please remember that we are an ear, nose, and throat and facial plastic surgery, so we're in a very tight spot, and we are in body cavities that are very small, and they're all above the neck. Our physicians are specially trained in these areas. So through our committee efforts, we track infections caused by our surgeries, and contrary to rumors that have been spread by unknown sources, our patients do not show up in the ER with infections or post-surgery complications. So are we safe compared to hospitals? I think we do a better job. Our patient satisfaction surveys run very high. We have a 98% satisfaction rate, and for those people who return unsatisfaction, that's where our QI committee comes into play. We are accredited by DHS, and we just had our second inspection in 6 years. We are also Medicare through the DHS process, and we just recently passed our third Joint Commission accreditation of healthcare facilities. I am proud to show you, and I just brought this as a sample because I am so proud of our organization. This is our accreditation from JCO. This is from our 2004-2007 inspection, and we just finished our 2007-2009 inspection. These are the standards that we follow. I'm not going to give you this because it will put you to sleep very easily. However, I do think that it is very important for you to know that we take quality of our organization very seriously. We feel like that the JCO is probably the most important inspection because we want to be on the same level as hospitals.
Mr. Bell?
Yes.
If you wouldn't mind, I'll interrupt you just a second. So on the JCO issue, I think it's great you do that. I don't have a good sense of how many surgical centers do it, and I'm wondering if you'd rather see everyone do it. How do you feel about everyone being required to do that? If you're already doing it, to have that kind of accreditation, to have some standards across your industry, I'm just wondering why you decide why your location does it and why others shouldn't.
Well, we felt very strongly, number one, about the quality. We also wanted to cut down our potential for malpractice cases. We also wanted to be sure that the level of our staffing and the way we were doing things was proper and according to national regulations. So I think there are a few others in the state that are JCO certified, but there's another organization called AAAHC, which is also an accrediting body. Some people prefer to do it that way. I think there's a third and there's a fourth. Nancy could probably address the other two, but we just chose to do it. We do spend about $6,000 to $10,000 a year, because the accreditation itself is around $6,000, and then the extra time and effort that we have to go through to do this is very expensive. And so we feel very proud that this is our third passage of a JCO inspection. So why do we do it? Well, it was the intention of our physicians to be the highest quality, and I've showed you my physical excerpts from the different standards. We have our license. This is our third one, and even though they don't use a scoring system now, the first time we had 99 out of 100, the second time 97 out of 100. I feel very good about those scores. And this time, we were fully accredited. So I think just to end mine so you can get on with the rest of the business, I think as an administrator for both the facilities that I work for and the doctors I work for, we have a high-quality organization. We don't take quality less serious than anyone else. We had no deaths in our facility. We've had no malpractice cases. And all of this can be attributable to the high-quality physicians and staff that we have. And thank you very much.
Thank you. Questions for Mr. Bell? Representative Bonamici.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just a quick one. Mr. Bell, it sounds like you're doing a lot of things to improve patient safety. And I wonder if specifically then what your problems are, because you signed up in opposition to this bill, what specific provisions? It sounds like you're already complying with a lot of it. So where are your problems?
My problem is in the length of times, the anesthesia times, the fact that the bill introduces more legislation to create more inspections by DHS when we already do inspections by JCO. I think the informed consent problem is that we actually don't do that necessarily in the surgery center. That's done by the physicians when they tell the patients about their surgery. And so those are the things that I'm opposed to.
Thank you. That's helpful. Thank you. Dr. Johnson.
Hi. Representative Kotek and Vice Chair Bruin, thank you for allowing me to speak. My name is Bruce Johnson. I'm an otolaryngologist in private practice here in Salem, and I do have part ownership in this ambulatory surgery center about which Mr. Bell just spoke. I'm also on the board of directors of the Oregon Patient Safety Commission, and I represent ambulatory surgery centers on that commission. I've chaired a subcommittee of the commission that's currently drafting rules for the reporting of errors in these facilities. I've had the opportunity in that position to review safety guidelines for surgical procedures done in both hospital and ambulatory settings, and our committee has worked hard to develop guidelines that will improve the safety and the reliability of surgical care provided in ASCs. The quality of care that I think is provided in my facility, River Road Surgery Center, is very high. I won't go into that. I've got some details here that Dennis also included. Our staff is small. They're cohesive. They're well-trained. And they know our procedures well, and so that there's a constant dialogue between the staff and the physicians that helps us to kind of refine our procedures. And it allows me to have my specific preoperative and postoperative plans accurately explained to patients because my nursing staff knows what I do and works with me regularly. And I know exactly what I can expect from both the nurses and the anesthesiologists who work at our center because we both work together and we're very comfortable with what we each do. And I think this provides less variability in the way things are done and less likelihood for error. And eliminating variability is one of the central tenets of quality improvement. And I think that improvement is fostered by repetition. And we do many of the same cases day after day, week after week. Because of this intimate environment, closer relationships are also developed between the staff and patients that we see, and our patient satisfaction rate reflects this. It's extremely high, and people often tell us how much more they enjoy their experience in a small setting like this than they did in a similar procedure done in the hospital. Regarding the specific language in the bill, I don't know of any tenets of patient safety that suggest that operations lasting longer than 90 minutes are inherently more dangerous than shorter procedures. A four-hour recovery time is a laudable goal, and I think that's one that we usually achieve, but I don't think that you can really predict how long the recovery time will be with virtually any procedure. And then I think to mandate a certain length of recovery time could actually be a disincentive to providing adequate post-anesthesia care. Other things in the bill would, there's a section that would prohibit operations with a risk of extensive blood loss. But the risk isn't quantified. This is a risk that I discuss with my patients with almost any procedure that I do, and I usually impress upon them that the risk is very low. Some people are concerned about an extremely low risk. I tell them some of the risks are lower than what they would suffer driving a car to Portland, but some people are fixated upon that. I think to just talk about a risk without quantifying it is a dangerous thing. The bill would prohibit major or prolonged invasion of body cavities. And I'd like to know what constitutes major or prolonged and what is a cavity. Because I routinely drill into patients' mastoid cavities to eliminate chronic ear disease. I open their paranasal sinus cavities to treat chronic sinusitis, and I remove tonsils from the oral cavity. All of these procedures could theoretically be prohibited by this bill. Ambulatory surgery centers have been well established in the state of Oregon and nationally. They're currently subject to both federal and state regulation, and many submit to voluntary regulation from organizations such as JACO. Their quality of care is very high in general, and this is reflected in the high patient satisfaction scores that are routinely seen from ASCs. Charges for a procedure done in a hospital are almost always significantly higher than for the same procedure done in an ASC. Both patients and insurers appreciate this lower cost, yet high quality care. Ambulatory surgery centers provide a structured, highly predictable environment that is a joy to work within and provides an environment for patients that is safe, economical, and effective. I think the system is not broken and certainly doesn't need this particular fix. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Questions?
One question.
Representative Brew.
And this may be, rather than representatives from individual surgery centers, it may be better for the association itself. I'll throw it out to you because it would directly affect you. I heard that you, one of the things that, Mr. Bell, I heard one of the things that you were opposed to was the increased inspections, but I guess I would ask from a general overview, would the surgery centers, either individually or collectively, be opposed to the part of the bill which increases the annual fee from annual license fee from $1,000 to $2,000 with the understanding there are going to be inspections more often than every 10 years?
Well, my thing on this is that we would like to see this across the board. We have singled out ASCs in this particular bill to go from $1,000 to $2,000.
Mm-hmm.
It's my understanding also that DHS is proposing an increase from $1,000 to $1,400. That to me is a little bit more palatable, but the whole issue of across-the-board increase without an increase to the rest of the hospital, or not the hospital, but healthcare organizations, doesn't seem fair.
Okay.
Before you go, and then I'd like to have next person on the list is Lynn Scapes, because you traveled from a distance. I want to make sure we hear you today. Do any of you have concerns about the rapid expansion in the industry and wanting to make sure that the high quality that you say you have, and I have no reason to doubt that, continues to be that way? The more, you know, more procedures, more time spent at centers, any kind of sense that there has to be some sideboards on where the industry is going? Any concerns about that? You're growing at a very fast rate.
Well, I think that a lot of those concerns are being addressed now. That's why it seems to me as the people were speaking in favor of this bill, nobody really had any specifics on what problems were being fixed. And I think one of the things we're concerned about is this setting arbitrary limits on what can and can't be done in these centers. And I don't think we've gotten really a clear picture about how well regulated these ambulatory surgery centers are and what the majority of them are doing. I think there can always be bad apples, whether it's ambulatory surgery centers or hospitals, some that perhaps need more regulation. And I'm just concerned that we're sort of focusing on a problem that's been identified by somebody that really hasn't elaborated the problem very well.
Do you want to respond?
Yeah.
In regards to that, I think that we're seeing a increase in Oregon that has been prevalent throughout the U.S., and it has a lot to do with the type of insurance companies we've had in the past that were hard to get into, especially in the Portland area. A few years ago, an ASC couldn't get started because they couldn't get contracting. So I think that's why you're seeing it grow a lot faster right now.
Thank you. Thank you for your testimony. I'm sorry, Representative Flores.
Well, I just have a comment.
Question for.
I think
okay.
A comment, if I might.
No.
And Madam Chair, in regard to the phrasing of your question, that you are growing at a great rate, and it sounded to me like, who is to measure what is a acceptable rate of growth in a system where people are trying to find health care costs that aren't through the roof? So if we're talking about rate of growth, are we trying to dampen rate of growth, arbitrarily insert an acceptable rate of growth? So I'm kind of trying to get some clarity
question.
On your question.
Thank you, Representative Flores. No, I think it's my challenge with this is, and would be good to compare other types of health services and how they're growing side by side to get some sense of, is there a disproportionate growth or is this just growth across the healthcare industry? I don't know the answer to that question. But I do know that just from the number of centers, there's more procedures being done in centers in an industry that, to all intents and purposes, we don't have a good sense of what's going on. You say there are no problems, and I have no reason to believe that. That's not the case, but we don't know for sure when we are off-regulating other parts of the healthcare industry to guarantee quality. So I think it's the question of, as you do more procedures and there's more going on, but not a kind of increased oversight, do we need that? And I don't have a good sense of what the answer is on.
Thank you. I was just trying to get clarity of where you're trying to position that.
No, I appreciate that. Other questions? Thank you. Lynn, Stapes, please. And then I'm going to do a few more minutes to get a couple more. The other person I really want to hear from is David Schlachtus, because you wanted to talk about the conceptual amendments. And, again, was there anyone else besides Ms. Stapes that came from 100 miles or more?
Well, but for the record, while the panel's getting settled, I did, on the issue of growth, want to point out that in the DHS letter, they talked about 73 facilities in 2006, but Franson talked about 77, so it went from 73 to 77, and I wondered if DHS doesn't know about the other four.
Mistake.
You're on.
Licensed and certified, they probably do.
You're on.
Madam Chair, honorable committee members, my name is Lynn Stapes, and I'm the administrator of McKenzie Surgery Center in Eugene. I am a master's prepared registered nurse by trade. Prior to coming to McKenzie, I've worked over 20 years in acute care facility. And before I forget, because it isn't in my written testimony, I will tell you that I'm not quite sure about the testimony that was provided by DHS, because they've been bugging me twice in the last 6 years. I've been open 10 years, and so we've had 3 visits over the 10 years. Also, of course, the Joint Commission, because we are accredited there, they come every 3 years. And so since 2000 of our accreditation, they have come. We've had 3 visits from the Joint Commission. So we're not, as an industry, running amok, I don't think. McKenzie Surgery Center was the first multi-specialty ASC in the Eugene-Springfield area. We perform neurosurgical, general, gynecological, podiatry, ophthalmology, pediatric dental, and plastic procedures. McKenzie employs 35 health professionals and has served over 25,000 patients since 1996. Our sister facility is North Bank Surgery Center in Salem. They've been open for 23 years and have safely provided outpatient surgical procedures to over 88,000 patients. Both centers are accredited by oversight agencies. We are Joint Commission, and North Bank is AAAHC. Over the past 10 years, McKenzie has provided a vital role in providing care in Eugene and outlying county healthcare community. Our patient population includes 20% Medicare and Medicaid patients. The percentage would be higher, however, the CMS guidelines prohibit a lot of Medicare patients from having the opportunity to having procedures at our facility. But as you may or may not know, the Medicare Modernization Act has mandated that they revamp their system, and so that will open the doors to opportunities for Medicare patients, more Medicare patients, to come to our facility.
Ms. Dapes, yeah. Danner, is that the same case for Medicaid?
It's a combined. Actually, it's 12% Medicaid patients and 8% Medicare is the breakdown, but it's a total of 20% of the two.
Oh, thank you. No, I was referring about the inability to have Medicaid patients. Is it Medicare and Medicaid?
No, certainly. There is no limitations on the Medicaid population that can come to us.
Okay, thank you. And I don't want to make you rush, but in the interest of time, I might say highlight the parts you want to get to, just because we need to wrap up on the bill.
The Hospital Association was instrumental in the introduction of Bill 3269. It should be obvious that their intent is to undermine the ASC industry under the guise of concern for patient safety, when in fact this is all financially motivated. Hospitals view ASCs as skimming the cream off the top or cherry-picking the best cases. What really is occurring is an evolution in the patient care industry. 80% of all surgical procedures are performed in an outpatient setting. For years, hospitals have monopolized surgical care without competition. And because of this, hospitals have been very slow to respond to the issues that plague hospitals: infections, complications, wrong-site surgery, and preventable deaths, to name a few. As in any industry, competition is good. In fact, our presence in the community has forced the local hospital to provide better equipment and better service to physicians, since they now know what it's like to have good customer service. If 3269 has been submitted out of concern for patient safety, then there is a misplaced concern. There has been no literature published that supports the idea that ASCs cannot safely perform outpatient procedures and at the same level of a hospital. If the proponents of the bill are so concerned about patient safety, they should clean up their own egregious situation and try to achieve the same levels of patient care that our surgery center provides. Both ASCs and hospitals provide outpatient surgery. 3269 places undue restrictions on ASCs that are not expected in the hospital outpatient surgical department setting without any justification.
Can I interrupt for a moment?
Yes, Representative Greeley.
You may have noticed my name's on the bill.
Mm-hmm.
I would prefer you not intimate what my motivations were, especially my motivations being bad in introducing that bill.
Well, I apologize if you took it in that manner. However, I believe that the Hospital Association testified that this is regarding patient safety, and they have not proved their case. They have brought a bill up.
Madam Chair?
Yes, let me follow.
I wrote the first article in 1980 published on these kinds of procedures, favoring them, these kinds of institutions. Mm-hmm. And I really do want to warn you, we have strong norms around here about impugning motives on members of the legislature. And since my name's on that bill, I really would prefer you not impugn my motives.
And actually, if I may jump in, I'd rather not focus on the intent of why the bill's forward, although I understand your perspective. We have it in writing. Could we get to the section of your testimony that talks about the specific concerns with the bill?
Sure.
That might be of most use at this point. Thank you.
And once again, I want to apologize. Being someone who has not interacted in this type of forum before, I apologize. I would like to address Section 3, which mandates redundant systems for ventilation, heating, water, and sanitation. In an acute hospital, I believe that redundant systems for sewage is not expected. What I believe is that this place is unrealistic or unfair and unnecessary requirements. However, being JACO accredited, we do have a generator, as was testified before, that in the event, and we have processes, in the event that our systems go down, that we would be able to provide care for those patients safely, finish those cases that are in the procedures, and then end the day. We would never put a patient at risk. That is not the intention, and because of the regulations that DHS already imposes, those are well covered.
If I may, would you be in support of saying that the redundant system issue, as long as it matched JACO versus...
That would be fine.
Okay. Thank you.
Section 4 attempts to define those patients that may go to an ASC. Overall, the requirements are more restrictive than the ASC regulations in place since 1991. Time limits are an antiquated definition of appropriateness for ASC procedures. Medical and pharmaceutical advances have dramatically changed and will continue to change the abilities of surgery. Simple procedures such as pediatric dental or eye lifts to enhance vision would be forced into the hospital due to the proposed surgical time limit. Time is not a good indicator of appropriateness for outpatient procedures. And even as I mentioned before, the CMS Modernization Act that is occurring right now, that is under consideration that time will be lifted for Medicare patients. The physiologic restrictions are worded such that procedures appropriate for an ASC setting would not be allowed. Tubal ligation reversals, which involves a major cavity and take approximately 2 hours to do due to the microsurgical technique, is appropriate for an ASC setting and have been performed at our surgery center for years, however, would not no longer be appropriate given these guidelines. Porta or Grosjean catheters typically placed for IV access for cancer patients would not be allowed, because they are placed via a major vessel. This procedure can be and is placed on nursing floors in hospitals and in some instances in physician offices. Since ASC perform, by the bill's definition, outpatient surgical treatment, a simplified yet appropriate definition for ASC procedures would be to define those procedures generally performed in an outpatient hospital setting.
Ms. Gibbs, if you would, could you wrap up? Because,
sure.
Again, we have your written testimony, but I want to make sure we hear two more people, and I need to hear another bill. But thank you for the detail of your testimony. I appreciate that.
The other concern I have here, and I guess basically for me, a lot of this definition is something that is over the top as far as what is appropriate. When you look at 80% of all hospital surgeries are done in an outpatient setting. An outpatient setting, as defined by our rules, is the same as an outpatient surgical setting. Hospitals have outpatient surgical settings. So if it is safe to do in an outpatient surgical setting, it should be safe to do in an ASC setting, provided that, as you guys have suggested, that perhaps the recommendation would be to take away from this is that they mandate that all ASCs be JACO, HHHC, or some identified or recognized body of certification. I have no problem with the state coming in. They come in any single day. We live JACO. You live JACO. You can screen through a state survey. It's not a big deal. We ASCs pride themselves in providing awesome care for their patients, because as a small business, if they don't take care of their doctors, if they don't take care of their patients, their doors close. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. And I would assume that if the bill was passed, we probably wouldn't need as much of the DHS, because people would be JACO or something. So there'd be some, it would just change who would be doing it. But
well, it could say one or the other come every 3 years. I mean, JACO comes every 3 years. So they could take the place of that and take the burden off the state. I also would encourage any of the representatives, if they have never been in an ASC, there are many. We have North Bank here, my surgery center, if anybody's in the Eugene area, to come down, tour it, and really understand what it is about to be an ASC.
Great. Thank you for your testimony.
Thank you.
And I want to call Dr. Jean up as well, briefly, and then Mr. Schlachtes?
Mm-hmm.
Can you run us through the conceptual amendments quickly, and then we need to wrap up on the bill. We need to hear the next bill. So.
Certainly.
But I think we have something in front of us.
Do you want Dr. Jenny first?
Actually, Dr. Jenny, you want to go first? And you are?
And I'm Dr. Jenny, CEO.
Okay, I only have time for one more. And I know, Dr. Jenny, I'm showing some courtesy to you, because apparently you arranged for the panel. You've taken a day off. I want to make sure you get heard. So. Just announce yourself for the record.
My name is Ryan Danny. I'm an anesthesiologist with Oregon Anesthesiology Group. We provide services for, we have 200 anesthesiologists, and we provide services for both ASCs and hospitals. And we are a large group that's concerned with, number one, patient safety. Number two, our concern primarily is that which resolves around the length of surgical cases and the time in the recovery room. I do not think that this is really appropriate in this bill and to be legislated at this point in time. Patient safety is paramount with regard to our specialty, as well as the surgeons and the nurses who work in ambulatory surgical settings.
And I think that we do have checks and balances in place. I think that one of the issues that we tend to look at are the fact that surgery centers are cost-effective, they are efficient, and if you, in fact, put in place an either-or with accreditation, I think that this would be palatable. But I think the major issue is to really be sure that you don't lock in or lock out the ability for patients to have a choice. I think that there's data that provides information that tells us that we do, across the board, take care of Medicare, Medicaid, no-pay, those who are insured. And I think the other thing that we do not have and you need to have is outcomes data. I think that there have been issues that have been painted or scuttlebutted around that relate to hearsay, but the state and many states do not have outcome data, which is incredibly important not only for statistics, cost, patient safety, but for all of Oregonians. And I'd like to ask a privilege that if you let Joy speak just for a couple of seconds, because she really has an overview of 200 anesthesiologists providing services all the way from Portland to Eugene area.
Please. I will give 2 minutes to both of you, so you need to decide. If you want to go over the conceptual amendments, that would be my preference. Is there additional that we haven't heard yet that you want to add to the testimony?
Madam Chairman, I thank you for the courtesy of allowing both of us this time. The only thing I'll point out is in our written testimony.
Your name for the record. Sorry.
Pardon me. It's Joy Ketchum, CEO for Oregon Anesthesiology Group. And so the written testimony that I've provided you today will speak to a bunch of things, one of which is a question that's been asked several times by Representative Boone around the length of time of surgery. If it's appropriate, we can serve as a reference for a good bit of statistical data on some of those things, and I yield to this gentleman.
Thank you. I appreciate you for being brief, and thank you for being here. And last minute or so was yours. You
right. Chair Kotek, representative of the committee. My name is David Schlachtis. I'm the CEO of Willamette Surgery Center and Willamette Orthopedic Group, and I'm going to have to go really fast.
And maybe just the very big highlights, because we can read through
yes. Just to let you know, our facility down the street is JCO accredited. We provide care regardless of the type of insurance. Hopefully you've seen the information that talks from the Office of Oregon Health Policy Research that shows that ASCs as a whole provide actually more care to Medicare patients than hospital outpatient departments do. We provide about the same amount of care to Medicaid patients. And just to give you a perspective, our facility last year lost $380,000 providing care to Medicare patients, and we lost $40,000 providing care to Medicaid patients. We think that's the right thing to do. That's what we should be doing for our community. So in terms of this bill, we think that transparency is paramount, and we will be providing some amendments which we think are very logical. You've already heard some of them come up. We think being accredited by either JCO or some other body, the body is logical, and we would support that. Representative Chair Kotek, you also asked about Section 3 and whether or not if you decided that JCO regulations with regard to redundancy would be appropriate. We think that's appropriate. We agree with you on there. You heard a lot of testimony on Section 4, and I guess what we would say is rather than limiting it based on time, it should be based on the federal guidelines so that if Medicare says that it can be safely done in a hospital outpatient department, then it can be safely done in an ASC. There's no reason why it should be any different. Our facilities, our emergency care facilities are the same. With regard to Section 7, Disclosure of Financial Interest, you should know that we already put that stuff in our brochures that every patient gets. They know that the surgeon that is doing the case has a financial interest in our facility. We think that's a great idea. In fact, if we're talking transparency, I think not only should the surgeon say, you're going to have care in a surgery center, and by the way, I have a financial interest. But I think they should also say, you've chosen to do a hospital stay. By the way, you can save money if we do this in a surgery center. If we're really interested in transparency and giving the patient full information and full disclosure, then they should know if they're going to go, if their surgeon's taking them to the hospital, that by the way, your copay, which is 20%, is going to be $100, $200 less if you do it at a surgery center. Let the patient make that decision. The same thing is true with regard to Section 8, Disclosure of Risk. If if the regulation is that we should tell them that there might be risks and it might be safer to do it at a hospital, then if they're going to the hospital, we should say, you know what, the infection rate at the surgery center is about zero and the infection rate at this hospital is about X percent. You choose as a patient. So conceptually, those are what we think are the amendments that would make sense to this bill. In closing, I would encourage you to encourage the Oregon Ambulatory Surgery Association and the Hospital Association to sit down with members of the committee and see if we can create a bill that enhances the whole environment for patients in the state.
Thank you. Thank you for the overview. Questions on the conceptual, although we'll have time for more discussion on this, I'm sure. Representative Bonamici?
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I'll be very brief. The part about the disclosure of the possibility of saving money and the infection rates, we've heard other bills addressing those issues, and I don't know if you meant that you wanted, they're not written in here, you added those. I don't know if you really want those in here or not. I can't tell if that's something that you're suggesting in the big picture sense might be good, or do you want them in this bill?
Chair Kotek, Representative Bonamici, preferably no, but you know what, if it's in the best interest of all Oregonians that they have full disclosure, then great, then let's have full disclosure. What this bill is representing is partial disclosure. We just want to tell patients that ASCs may not be the best place for them. Well, there are times when a hospital may not be the best place for them. Our turnover times, the amount of time that the patient is in the ASC is substantially less than the time that they're in the hospital. We have statistics that show that. We have faster turnover times. We have incredible customer service satisfaction scores. So I think as a legislative body, as a society, as a state, we should go one direction or the other, either full disclosure and tell the patients everything or not. So if we want to tell them everything, great, let's tell them everything.
Thank you. Representative Ford?
I don't have a question for him. I have a question for you.
Okay.
So I'll wait.
Thank you. Thank you for your testimony.
Thank you.
And I just want to say for the record that something that we didn't get to necessarily on the cherry picking issue, there was some information provided about the source of payer source for some of the ASC services that are provided either in freestanding surgical centers or hospital-based. You're both seeing too few Medicaid patients. That's all I want to say about that. Okay? So I appreciate the conceptual amendments, and my intention is to do something on this bill because I do think that there's room for some discussion. I appreciate the dialogue. Representative Flores, you had a question?
And thank you. If we are going to do something on this bill, some of the information I would like to have is from the Hospital Association. I would like to know, and I probably should know this, but I do not, these things. Number of hospitals we have. Most of them, I understand, are nonprofit, but how many are there? Are there any for-profit hospitals? There used to be one up in the Portland area. I don't know if there are, and I think there's one in Eugene, but I don't know if there are others around the state. And then the numbers that are physician-owned. I think there had been one in the past, and I'm talking hospital facilities now. So that's the type of information I would also like to consider as we're contemplating doing something.
Thank you, and we will get that information for the committee. And other information requests while you have everyone here? Seeing none, thank you very much, everyone. We'll close the public hearing on House Bill 3269. And I did say we'd give the second bill a whole another hour. With that, I'll open House Bill 2701. However, I made a commitment to committee members we will be done by 5, so we will not do a 4-hour on 2701. So people have to be succinct. I really would appreciate that. Sandy, what bill are we looking at?
Madam Chair, members of the subcommittee.
And if people could keep it down while they're exiting the room, thank you very much.
House Bill 2701 comes to us from Chief Sponsor Representative Barnhart at the request of the Chiropractic Association of Oregon. It is excluding any chiropractic from the practice of physical therapy. And I believe you have some amendments behind your brief.
Okay. Oh, excluding chiropractic services on physical therapy. I'm sorry, Sandy.
The practice of physical therapy.
I thought you were saying we're stopping chiropractors from doing physical therapy.
Mm. And we have a dash one and a dash.
That's what it says.
Two amendments. Well, I thought we had another one, but we don't. And
do we have amendments?
We do.
Oh, wait, they're there.
Yes. And they will speak to us. The dash ones are from the Chiropractic Association. And the dash twos are from the Physical Therapy Association, Oregon Association of Physical Therapists.
Thank you, Sandy. We have several people signed up in opposition, and I appreciate everyone traveling here. No one's come from more than 100 miles except Karen Waltz. Thank you. So what we're going to do is I'd like Dr. Sabo and Melissa Bubidia. Did I get that close? to speak, you're the proponents of the bill. I'd like to hear from you. And then we'll have Tracy Rutan, Karen Waltz, and Genoa Ingram. I appreciate people signing up in opposition, but I'll be very honest. It's pretty crystal clear where the physical therapists are on this bill, I must say. The number of emails have made that very obvious, and I appreciate everyone being here. So if we do have time for additional testimony after these five individuals, I would ask that you just speak specific. Try to keep it brief, because I do have a sense of where you are on the bill as it is written. So Dr. Sabo, you're up.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Vern Sabo, representing the Chiropractic Association of Oregon. I'm here to testify in support of and give the rationale for House Bill 2701. House Bill 2701 simply reinserts a sentence that was deleted last session via House Bill 3260. And that sentence specifically said physical therapy does not include chiropractic as defined in ORS 684.010. That sentence was removed last session, and late in session Guttenstuff Amendment, which was not copied to the Chiropractic Association of Oregon nor the Oregon Board of Chiropractic Examiners. That sentence existed in statute specifically as a patient safety issue and preventing physical therapists from attempting to perform chiropractic adjustments or spinal manipulation as they do not receive adequate training to perform that service. ORS 684.010, our practice act, and very pertinent to this discussion, defines chiropractic as that system of adjusting with the hands, the articulations of the bony framework of the human body. It goes on to state that it is the employment and practice of physiotherapy, electrotherapy, hydrotherapy, and minor surgery. As the bill went to the governor's desk, executive director of the Oregon Board of Chiropractic Examiners voiced the profession's concerns in a blue sheet to the governor, which specifically stated that we recommend you obtain written assurance from the bill's sponsors, the Oregon Physical Therapy Association and the Oregon Physical Therapy Licensing Board, that the intent of House Bill 3260 is not to expand the physical therapist's scope of practice into chiropractic spinal manipulation. House Bill 3260 contains language which deletes the provision prohibiting physical therapists from performing chiropractic spinal manipulation. This allows a major change in scope of practice. However, the significance of this provision was not explained to the legislature. Amendments of this bill were gut and stuff late in the session and were not copied to the Board of Examiners, Chiropractic Examiners, for review. Mr. McTeague goes on to state that nationally, physical therapists have been pushing to broaden their scope of practice to include spinal manipulation. The chiropractic profession is rightly concerned that minimum qualifications to perform these procedures were not considered or addressed in the legislative hearing process. I have spoken with Genoa Ingram, lobbyist for the Oregon Physical Therapy Association, who says they did not intend this bill to be a major change in physical therapy scope of practice in this area. We request, at a minimum, the understanding be memorialized in written communications to the governor's office. The Oregon Board of Chiropractic Examiners has a definite interest in ensuring any practitioner of spinal manipulation is trained to a competent level. Thank you for your consideration of this request. Subsequent to Mr. McTeague's letter, the Physical Therapy Licensing Board and the Physical Therapy Association both wrote letters to the governor indicating that their intent was not to broaden their scope to include chiropractic adjusting or spinal manipulation. You have both these letters in your packet. Physical Therapy Licensing Board specifically stated it is in its conversations with the Physical Therapy Licensing Board, the Oregon Physical Therapy Association did not present House Bill 3260 as a change in scope of practice. That was not the intent of the bill. The Physical Therapy Association parrots that statement by saying it is not the intent of House Bill 3260 to increase the scope of physical therapy practice in any way. Following that, Dave McTeague sent an email to the governor's health policy advisor, copied to Genoa Ingram, lobbyist for the physical therapist, wherein he states, "With these letters, we have a written record on file that there was no legislative intent to change the physical therapist's scope of practice to encompass chiropractic spinal manipulation." The governor, writing the then-speaker minutes, voices the same concerns that our profession had, that in removing the sentence was an attempt to broaden the scope of Physical Therapist Practice Act to include chiropractic spinal manipulation. The governor goes on to say, and you have this letter, that in fact he's received letters from the Physical Therapist Association and the Physical Therapist Licensing Board, stating that that was not their intent to expand their scope to include chiropractic spinal manipulation, and with those assurances, he was signing the bill. In the ensuing months, we began to get comments and complaints by chiropractic colleagues wherein they were co-treating with a physical therapist, a patient, or wherein a physical therapist had treated the patient prior, and then the consumers switched to a chiropractic physician, wherein the physical therapists were stating that because of something that had transpired last session, they could now do chiropractic adjustments. Out of concern, the president of Access Healthcare, Dr. Dan Beebe, asked Melissa Babadella, who is sitting to my right, to contact the Physical Therapy Licensing Board for clarification. And in her conversation, which is documented in her letter of November 30th, 2006, to Dr. Beebe, she speaks to the issue of the conversation with a Sherry Peru, who I believe is a clinical advisor and an investigator with the board and a licensed physical therapist, where in that conversation, Ms. Peru stated that Oregon State is one of the few states that allow physical therapists to perform chiropractic adjustments. She apparently went on to state that this is permitted because the physical therapist rules are not specific as to exclude such procedures or techniques. Ms. Babadella will testify after me and give you a little more of the conversation, a little more in-depth about that conversation. Part and parcel, and very specifically addressing this issue, and I think it's important, is last month the director of the physical therapy school and the lead instructor, Bob Nee, the director of the physical therapy school being a Richard Rutt, testified in front of the Senate Health and Human Services Committee, Senator Bill Morissette's committee, that in fact the Pacific University School of Physical Therapy specifically does not instruct in chiropractic adjustments. They went on to say that they do not instruct their students in chiropractic spinal manipulation, affirmating that in fact their students do not receive training in this area. Again, our practice act specifically, the key terminology which defines chiropractic and which is the focus of our concern, is that system of adjusting with the hands the articulations of the bony framework of the human body. Now, in conversations with a physical therapist a couple of weeks ago, Tracy Rutten indicated that the physical therapist had a concern with the fact that our practice scope included, our practice act language included, the term physiotherapy. That if in fact the sentence is reinserted, physical therapy does not include the practice of chiropractic, and that definition of chiropractic includes physiotherapy, that somehow this would prevent physical therapists from performing physical therapy or physiotherapy. Though we disagree that that doesn't make logical sense, and with that sentence in statute prior, no physical therapist had ever been barred from doing physical therapy. We, as a compromise, suggested the -1 amendments. And that specifically states that the practice of physical therapy does not include adjusting with the hands the articulations of the human body, the bony framework of the human body, Madam Chair and members of the committee, that completes my testimony. I'd be more than happy to answer any questions you might have.
Thank you, Dr. Sabo. Actually, why don't we hear from Ms. Bobadilla?
For the record, my name is Melissa Babadi. I'd just like to talk to you a little bit about the conversation I had with Sherry Peru. I don't recall exactly from my notes when the conversation took place, but it was sometime in October. At that time, I had met with Dr. Daniel Beebe, who had asked me to do some research on this issue. I contacted her and asked her at that time whether there was any limitations to chiropractic treatment that physical therapists were not allowed to do. And she's the one that actually directed me to the OAR, which is 848-040-0145, number 2. And she mentioned to me that they were able to do chiropractic adjustments and that Oregon State was one of the few states that allowed it. She even gave me the example that Washington State does not permit this. And I asked her, well, what kind of training must a physical therapist undergo then? And she mentioned that there's no specific training that they need to undergo. And then I asked her right there and then, well, how are they able to do this? And she said, well, we're able to get away with it because of number 2 in the OER that I just cited to you. She says the only thing their physical therapists are required to have is qualified education. And again, I asked her, well, what is qualified education? That's actually pretty broad. And she mentioned to me, well, as long as they have any type of education. And that's when I asked her. I said, well, does that mean, for example, I said I'm a lawyer. If I just went to a continuing legal education, a weekend course, does that satisfy the education requirement? And she said, yes, that's sufficient under the rules. If you have any questions, I'm available.
Thank you for your testimony, and I appreciate you being here because apparently this is a bone of contention in terms of what was the content of that conversation in terms of this discussion. So thank you for being here. Representative Gelsler?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Do you know when the last update of the administrative rules, were the administrative rules updated after the new statute was passed? After the ORS was passed, were the OARs then updated?
Chair Kotek, Representative Gelsler, no, I'm not clear on when and if the administrative rules were updated.
Thank you.
Representative Flores?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I was looking at the bill that Dr. Sabo was referencing, and since you have the ORS in front of you, and I wanted to look to see, because the definition of physical therapy that was taken out by virtue of House Bill 3260, we don't have the subsequent pages. Was there a definition of physical therapy that was left in the bill on following pages? You just gave us page 1.
Chair Kotek, Representative Flores, you're asking me what the definition of physical therapy is?
In statute.
I could not quote it verbatim, but I think the physical therapist would be more than happy to tell you that.
So if you, when the physical therapists come up.
This section.
Perhaps, Madam Chair, I think you have the volume of ORS yes. That's there. And thank you. That might answer my question.
Thank you, Representative. Sorry to be hoarding the book there.
With the Oregon Administrative Rule, I'm trying to figure out how the Administrative Rule reflects the change from the last legislative session, since that the OAR that's quoted doesn't specifically talk about a chiropractic adjustment. A physical therapist shall perform or attempt to perform techniques or procedures only with qualified education and experience. I'm wondering if the change wasn't so much in the administrative rule as it was in the statute. So what that meant in the rule may have changed because of the change in the statute in terms of what that scope of practice was related to appropriate training.
Chair Kotek, Representative Gelsler, actually the administrative rules are more helpful. They actually helped gave guidance as to the interpretation of the statute. So that's actually what we turn to, and most agencies would turn to, is the administrative rule to give guidance into what the interpretations are. I'm not sure if that answers your question.
Madam Chair, can I clarify? I think what I'm trying to understand in the Oregon Administrative Rule, in terms of the way that it talks to the statute, so you have the statute and the rules have to be consistent with the statute. So anytime you narrow a statute, you'd have to go back and narrow the rules. But if you broaden, then they wouldn't broaden. So even though it's instructive,
I'm just wondering if they were updated and changed after the change in law, or if the change is simply because the prohibition on doing chiropractic was removed from the statute, if that then broadened by definition the OAR, since it didn't speak to that issue directly.
Chair Kotek, Representative Gelser, we're looking at administrative rules, but the reality is I'm not sure if these have been updated. There is a subsection, specifically 3, that specifically speaks to a physical therapist or a physical therapist assistant shall perform. A physical therapist or a physical therapist assistant shall perform or attempt to perform techniques or procedures only with qualified education experience.
And maybe we can have physical therapists continue on that line of questioning on that issue.
Dr. Shaver, I have a question. Has the Board of Chiropractic Examiners taken a position on your bill?
They have not taken an official, Madam Chair, I don't know if they've taken an official position on the bill. I can tell you in casual conversation with the board members who are chiropractic physicians and the executive director who wrote the blue sheet that I could tell you my best guess would be that they would be in full support.
Thank you. Any other questions? Is there anyone else here to speak in support of the bill?
We're it. Hmm? No, there's not, Madam Chair.
Well, we appreciate your testimony. Thank you very much for being here.
Madam Chair?
Yes, Representative.
Can I ask one more question?
Oh, sorry, one more.
Thank you. And we've had some rather graphic descriptions recently in this committee. but I
controversy here.
I'm wondering, could you describe to me specifically what the adjustments of the bony body, the adjusting with the hands, the articulations of the bony framework of the human body. Could you describe specifically what that, I mean, is that massage or is that actually moving vertebrae around? And
Chair Kotek, Representative Gelser, that is specifically referring to a chiropractic adjustment, a high velocity, low amplitude thrust, or manipulation are all the same thing. You're moving vertebra around or an extremity. It is a quick, very precise thrust that goes into what's known as a paraphysiological space, but within anatomical integrity. So you're not spraining the joint. It takes a lot of skill and expertise to know not only where to perform it and how to perform it, but more importantly, when not to.
And can I do one more follow-up? So if the Dash 1 amendment were to be accepted and moved, if I think about what I imagine physical therapists doing, that would this language prevent people from doing range of motion kinds of things, massage kinds of practices, or would it just be that high velocity thrusting that they couldn't do?
Chair Kotek, Representative Gelser, it would only prevent the chiropractic adjustment, the high velocity thrust spinal manipulation.
Thank you for that clarification. I want to thank you for suggesting an amendment and response to some of the concerns from the physical therapists. And don't go away, we might have more questions. Right. Thank you. Next panel, can we have Tracy Rutan, Karen Waltz, and Diane Godwin? Whoever wants to start first.
Thank you, Chair Kotek and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Tracy Button. I'm here today on behalf of the Oregon Physical Therapy Association. And I'd like to thank you for the opportunity to testify in opposition to House Bill 2701 today. This bill, as you heard, would insert language back into the Physical Therapy Practice Act that had been previously removed as a result of the introduction and passage of House Bill 3260 in the 2005 legislative session. I, too, have included that legislative calendar, and actually I included, I believe, the House amendment just to show that actually the language and the removal of the language happened on the House side, went over to the Senate side, and got concurrence. It wasn't a last-minute amendment in any way. I have several concerns
today, I would really like to clarify and address some of the previous testimony. I feel strongly that there has been a huge perceived misconception. We have our concerns with putting that language back in. Obviously, there is some contradiction when you look at it. It just actually doesn't read very well, especially when you compare the definition of chiropractic and you tie it to the practice of physical therapy. But I'm actually not going to get much into that. I actually had the opportunity to spend several hours over the last few days at the State Archives building, and I had never done that before. But my goal was to find out what was the legislative intent of that language in the first place. After going through a lot of testimony that they had and a lot of exhibits, essentially, we have reason to believe, I think strong reason to believe, that the legislative intent of that language was never about manipulation, and that actually had to do with, and Diana Godwin was actually the lobbyist during 1987 when the bill passed. 1987 was actually a rewrite of the physical therapy statute. It actually first took place via, I think, Senate Bill 427. However, that bill passed the Senate side and didn't get scheduled for a hearing on the House side. The content of that bill was put in the Dash 12 amendment and put into a chiropractic bill that was on the Senate side. Actually, it was, had already passed to the Senate side. It was House Bill 2592. The bill that was the chiropractic bill was dealing with chiropractors as attending physicians and workers' comp and civil liability issues. When you look at the bill and then when you look at the fact that we stuffed our bill right behind theirs, one of the first things they did in that bill was to define chiropractic physician. And it said that chiropractic physician is somebody licensed by this 1987 Act as an attending physician. Well, the Act being the bill, physical therapists are not attending physicians. The amendment actually that inserted the language that is before you today to be reinserted happened in the very 11th hour. It was actually, I think, the day or 2 days before adjournment in the Senate Rules Committee about 5:30 p.m. And there was no discussion of that amendment other than it didn't create any, it wasn't substantial, it was some fixes, and they passed it right out with zero discussion or zero testimony. Currently, if you look at the definition of a chiropractic physician, you actually see that there's a reference back to the PT statute. So we really truly believe that this is actually not dealing with manipulation, and I'll just also say we've got a lot of people here who will speak. We're frustrated in some ways. We've done this on the Senate side once already, which was established that manipulation's been used by the PT profession in Oregon for years. I just spoke with Ann Porter-Hope, who's also signed up to testify. She's been doing it in Oregon since 1983. This isn't something that's been recently allowed as a result of the removal of that language, and that's been our frustration. Gosh, I'm so not with the written testimony. I apologize that I prepared for you today. But I'll say, you know, the language we think is very confusing. That is clear, and I think it led to this, which I think is a misconception of what that language means. I think it's very poorly drafted. I think it's confusing, and I think it's contradicting. We are regulated by our own physical therapist licensing board. They look at scope of practice issues. And I'd also like to just state that we do have Sherry Prue available to answer any questions today. She does have some concerns with the testimony and the report of that conversation as it happened. But I'll just say that the manipulation has been done in Oregon for a long time, that there are a lot of accreditation. The program actually in Oregon has to be accredited to offer and provide a minimum level of training in manual therapy techniques, including manipulation. And regardless of whether this legislation took place, PTs in Oregon would still have to be educated in the use of this procedure, regardless then of whether they could use it in Oregon, but it is mandated by our national accreditation. So they are educated, they are trained. We have no information from our licensing board, liability insurance providers throughout the nation to indicate that this increases the risk to patient safety. This is all stuff that we testified to on the Senate side when the Chiropractic Association put forward a bill to require some minimum standards for the use of this procedure that would have then eliminated physical therapists from the ability to use it. We established on the record then and had our professors testify that this is something they're trained to do, educated to do, and it hasn't created any patient safety issues. If they have some information that it has, we would like to see it and we'd like to address it, but none that we're aware of. And I'll turn it over.
Actually, Tracy, okay. I have a question.
Yes.
And thank you for your testimony. I'm sorry, and maybe it was just because I spaced for a moment there, but the punchline on looking at the archives and what the intent of the language was.
Yes.
Could you clarify that? So yes. We stuck in, there was a lot going on apparently.
This is just, trust me, I understand, because my concern testifying today was that there's a lot of factors going on here, which is A, are we educated in manipulation, and B, what was the legislative intent of the language? I'm looking at it now, and I wish now that I would have made copies. I didn't know that this was where the conversation would lead. This is Chapter 726, House Bill 2592, an act. The first part of this reads, under ORS 684.010, subsection 3, chiropractic physician means a person licensed by this 1987 act as an attending physician. And that is where we understand, and Diana was again there during that session, that the language happens. And it is odd if you look at that language now. Our statute is actually listed under chiropractic physician. It doesn't really make sense to me, but that's what we believe this is about.
I'd like to ask a question.
Okay, could you finish answering this particular topic really quick and announce yourself for the record, and then I'll take Representative Minlick and Representative Bonamici.
Madam Chairman, members. Madam Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Diana Godwin. I'm an attorney in private practice in Portland. In my current work, I am the legal counsel for a group of Oregon physical therapy clinics in independent practice. I represent 125 clinics throughout the state. I have practiced physical therapy law now for some 25 years. It's just about my exclusive area of practice. In 1987, I was, again, a lawyer, but also the outside contract lobbyist for the Oregon Physical Therapy Association when we were attempting to make a number of changes in the physical therapy law, the principal one of which was to update our definition of physical therapy, which had not been updated since 1953, and of course, as you know, the profession had evolved. We had a number of other issues in that bill, but principally we wanted to update our definition, and as Tracy said, the bill passed the Senate but got bogged down in the House committee, and as you know what happens around this building, particularly 20 years ago, things get pretty frantic. There was a bill that had passed both chambers. It was into conference committee. We knew it had a relating clause that would work for us. It was the chiropractor's bill, and one of the purposes of the chiropractor's bill was to clarify and define them as attending physicians. And back in 1987...
Godwin, can we speak to the...
I'm sorry.
I actually would love to hear about the history of the bill, but
okay.
To the specific question of the intent of the language that was...
The intent of the bill at that time was, since the bill into which we were putting our amendments on updating the definition of physical therapy was separately defining chiropractors as attending physicians in the workers' comp system, we wanted it very clear that physical therapists, however, were not to be attending physicians in the workers' comp system, never had been and aren't today, and that's fine. So in order to clarify that, since our bill was part of theirs and it was dealing with who was going to be an attending physician, at the last minute, an inartful amendment was drafted to say physical therapy practice does not include chiropractic. So that's kind of how that happened, but it was very inartful, as can sometimes happen in the closing days of a session in a conference committee.
Absolutely. Thank you.
But
thank
it did
you
not have anything to do with preventing physical therapists from doing manual therapy or manipulations, because we've always done that. Sorry.
Thank you. I appreciate it. That's actually super
helpful. I think that's the end of what I was going to say.
Okay, bye.
I think Representative Greenlick.
Yes, Representative Greenlick, and then Bonamici, and then
Nelson. Yeah, the question I have relates to he said, she said, and what you just said. statement was somebody called the physical therapy board and asked, can a physical therapist do chiropractic? And the assertion is the answer was yes. Oregon's one of the few states that can do that. So, first of all, I'd like to find out, was that said at that time, and would it be said now, and would it have been said before the statute that said physical therapy did not include chiropractic was deleted?
So we're going to have Sherry Proof with the licensing board talk to that.
Hi there. My name is Sherry Peru. I'm the clinical advisor physical therapist for the Oregon Physical Therapist Licensing Board. I would just like to say for the record that I don't recall the conversation at all. And I also would like to say for the record that, and this is my first time testifying to anything, so excuse me, and I'm a little annoyed So, sorry. I don't recall the conversation at all. I've had lots of conversations about this topic with various different people. I went back and researched through my notes what conversations and the dates that people have called me to ask me about, can physical therapists do chiropractic? Can chiropractics do physical therapists? I get that question a lot. The only person I have in my notes that I talked to was somebody named Tony Sabo. And I recall that conversation. I do not recall a conversation with this woman. I can say that I never say that a physical therapist does chiropractic manipulation. I get this question numerous times. I never say that. I say, yes, a physical therapist can do grade 5 mobilization and manipulation in the state of Oregon. If I had this conversation, it could very well be that I did say that there are other states that do not allow physical therapists to do any form of manipulation, because that's true. I don't know the rules in the state of Washington, so I don't think I would have said what they can do in the state of Washington, because I really don't know which states allow it and which states don't. But I do know there are quite a few states where there's been a pretty heated argument between the two groups, and there are some states where it's real specific that physical therapists cannot do any type of mobilization or manipulation.
I can follow up.
Yes.
I asked you, does physical therapy include chiropractic?
I would say no.
Okay.
And I can guarantee you that any conversation that I have when someone asks me that question, I say no. But I do then explain that physical therapists can do joint mobilization, grade 5 joint mobilization, and manipulation of joints in the body. So, yes, I would tell you that. But I would never say a physical therapist can do chiropractic. I wouldn't use the word chiropractic.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Representative Bonamici?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Boy, I hardly know where to start. I wonder, it seems like we're having some definitional differences. And I think that you would agree that physical therapists can't do everything that a chiropractor can do. Is that correct? Okay, so what is it?
Did you say that for the record?
Is that correct?
Okay, is that correct?
I'll actually defer to Karen Wells, but yes, correct.
Okay.
Correct. Karen, Madam Chair, Representatives, Karen Walls, physical therapist, practicing for over 23 years, board-certified manual physical therapist, president of Oregon Physical Therapy Association, and graduate of Stanford Medical School Division of Physical Therapy. I was instructed in manipulation and joint mobilization as a trainee in my training over 23 years ago. Physical therapists do not do chiropractic. In previous testimony, it was stated that chiropractic adjustment and subluxation were synonymous with spinal manipulation, which I would disagree with, and there's documentation to support that. Clinical reasoning differs between the professions. As I submitted to you written testimony from an osteopathic physician who is against this bill, osteopaths also manipulate.
Follow-up?
Thank you.
Yes?
Does where the people in Oregon go to learn physical therapy? Pacific University, and there's other places as well. Do they teach spinal manipulation?
Yes, they do.
And what do they call it?
Manipulation, grade 5 mobilization. And again, it's required by our CAPTI, our national accrediting body for our education. And we do have instructors here from Pacific University if you need to hear their testimony.
Well, to follow up, please.
Yes.
What I'm trying to get at is how we can articulate in the statute the difference between what physical therapists can and are allowed to do and what they can't do because they're not chiropractors. And it seems like we haven't reached that through any of this language. I can understand why it was taken out last time, because there is some overlap, because I think chiropractors can do most, if not all, of what physical therapists can do, but I don't think that physical therapists can't do, and you've confirmed.
Chiropractic is not defined as physical therapy, so I would disagree with your statement that chiropractors can do most or all of what physical therapists do. Physical therapy is a unique body of knowledge. That's when we have our scope of practice, and this law that was passed last year did not expand our scope of practice.
Okay, well, obviously there's some overlap, and I'm just trying to figure out how we can get the language to make it clear in the statute, because obviously it's not.
If I might, Chair Kotek and Representative Bonamici. Actually, we did, in speaking with Representative Kotek, Chair Kotek's office, we did offer to put our best effort forward to address the situation. At that time, we were a little unsure still of what situation we were actually addressing. We did put forward the Dash 2 amendments. That's really our best effort, and the thing that we can come up with, this is based on something that exists in another state, which reads that physical therapists may not represent that any manipulation service performed by the physical therapist is in any manner a chiropractic adjustment that is employed to correct a spinal subluxation. And for us, that really speaks to the very different philosophies between chiropractic and physical therapist. And, you know, I'll just say that there's a lot of overlap between the two professions. We overlap in massage therapists, occupational therapists, MDs even, in the services that are provided. It's really, for us, it's the philosophy behind that. It's the desired clinical outcome. It's the reasoning behind procedures that are used that differentiates these professions.
Thank you. Representative Gelser, and then I'm going to close this public hearing in about 3 minutes because I'm losing committee members and we're not going to be moving this bill today. Representative Gelser?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Bonamici asked part of the question that I was going to ask, which I was wondering, you know, how many hours of hands-on instruction happens, what kind of instruction experience is there, and it sounds like probably this is going to come back and we'll have that discussion then, but I wanted to make a comment before I left. I know that we're out of time today to move this bill. I really am very interested in moving something that clarifies and protects the chiropractic scope of practice. And I think just as a listener, something that's curious and confusing to me is that we were here not that long ago hearing a similar bill where the physical therapists were wanting to not allow chiropractors or occupational therapists or massage therapists to use words like physical therapy or physiotherapy. So it seems to me consistent that given that we moved that bill to protect a unique scope of practice for physical therapists, it would only be fair and appropriate that we would provide the same respect and walls and sideboards around chiropractic. And so it's just interesting to me to hear today about all of the overlap with occupational therapy and chiropractic when the testimony we heard related to the other bill was really quite different. I don't hear the chiropractors asking for something a whole lot different than before. I think the Dash 1 amendments look good to me, and I hope that we can move something that provides to the chiropractors the same degree of protection that we provided to the physical therapists just a few weeks ago.
Chair Kotek, if I might, really quickly, and Representative Gelser, I understand and I appreciate your concerns. I will remind you that actually our bill came out of committee very different and actually only deals with the direct access issue and another issue dealing with doctor. Our bill had exception language, and I just will point that out, that said this bill does not in any way prohibit any person who is licensed under their own scope of practice from doing anything that might be within the act of physical within the scope of practice of a physical therapist. Our concern was when you're advertising or you're implying or you're telling the patient it's physical therapy, just as we would not be physical therapists, I say we. We will not say that doing chiropractic or tell a patient this is chiropractic or advertise as performing services that are chiropractic. So we allow them to do anything within their scope of practice, and in no way we're attempting to limit them from using any procedure that they were authorized to use.
Representative Bonamici.
One more comment. Thank you, Madam Chair. I agree with Representative Gelser. I do want to address this issue. I want to see a bill that protects the scope of practice of chiropractic. And I don't think either of these amendments do it because I think that the Amendment 1 perhaps is not clear enough, and I think Amendment 2 has to do with what a physical therapist can represent, not what they can and can't do. So that doesn't solve the issue either. So I'd like to see some more work at how we can articulate protecting the chiropractic in what scope of practice without the overlap.
Okay, I'm going to jump in here, and here's what I would like. I would like some agreement here. I agree that we have a scope issue in the chiropractors. It is really unfortunate that two areas, though distinct disciplines, can't seem to get along better, to be very honest. Who I'm not seeing here in this discussion is the Board of Chiropractic Examiners and the Physical Therapy Board in a very official status. The boards need to work this out. I want to see an amendment that gets to the intentions that both representatives have expressed interest in, but with an understanding of where the physical therapists are. We're not trying to limit anyone's scope here in the sense that we're not trying to you do what you're supposed to do based on your training. We've got some issues from the chiropractors. I think they have some valid concerns. physical therapists have some bowel concerns, you need to work it out. I know you're with the board, so do you want
to... Yeah, I just wanted to say one thing, Chairperson Kotek, is that I am with the physical therapy board. Our executive director would be here. He was here the last time when we ran out of time. He had his hip replaced a week ago, so he cannot be here to represent the board. So... He would be here if he could. Believe me, he's watching it on the camera right there.
And I appreciate that clarification. Does the board, does the physical therapy board have a position on this bill?
No, the physical therapy board doesn't, because we kind of didn't know it was coming. I mean, the physical therapy board, I'm sorry to say it that way, but the physical therapy board strongly supports that we don't feel that physical therapists do chiropractic and have never felt that physical therapists do chiropractic and know that physical therapists in their training can do manipulation. So I agree with the, you know, what everybody's saying, that there's some sort of overlap. What I would like to say from the board is we've only had, I've been there for 5 years, and the 5 years I've been there, we've had two complaints that relate to physical therapists performing any type of chiropractic manipulation, and both of them were found to not be founded and were closed with no finding. So, and I also would like to say that I strongly feel that the physical therapy board and the chiropractic board have a very good relationship. So I don't want to feel that the licensing boards actually have a very good relationship, and we don't have any kind of an issue with each other at all. And it's frustrating for me to not see the chiropractic board here and to hear Mr. Sable say, well, I don't know. I think they'd support the bill, but I can't 100% say because they're not here.
Well, I appreciate the clarification. I do think it's important to have the boards talking. Obviously, we need some other folks looking at this. The dash ones and dash twos don't seem to meet any of our satisfaction. And so, please, continue talking. Representative Greenlee?
First of all, I think what you said was just perfect, but I'm a little perplexed. I mean, if the board says physical therapy does not include chiropractic, why should the physical therapist have a problem with a bill that says physical therapy does not include chiropractic? I mean, it seems simple to me. If that's your position, then what's wrong with this?
Could you restate your question, Chair?
Yeah. We've just heard from a representative of the board a clear statement that physical therapy does not include chiropractic. Do you agree with that statement?
I do agree with
that.
Then
what's wrong with this? With a bill that says physical therapy does not include chiropractic.
Chair Kotek, Representative Greenlee, our concern is that we don't believe the legislative intent had to do with manipulation. We believe their objective is dealing with manipulation, and that it ties us to...
I don't know what their objective. I'm talking about what the bill says.
Yeah, but it ties it to ORS 684.010, and I think it creates a lot of confusion, because if you look at that definition, it's very contradicting, it's very confusing if you read it that way.
Thank you, Tracy. And I actually, Representative Greenlee, I do think the definition of chiropractic gets into areas that might cause some problems.
Exactly. Right, because it includes hydrotherapy and physiotherapy, which that's why they don't want
to. How about taking the definition to 680 out and just have a statute that says physical therapy does not include chiropractic and put it in a physical therapy statute?
If I can just... sorry, Chairperson and Representative Green, like, I would just like to say that I did say that physical therapy is not chiropractic. I think what the issue is that what the definition of chiropractic is, or what the perception of from chiropractors of what physical therapists do. There are many physical therapists, and I'm sorry they're not here, they can't testify, but there are many people here that have been doing this type of treatment for years and years. There's people here that instructed to other physical therapists. The physical therapists have been doing manipulation and mobilization for years and years, and it's not chiropractic. So maybe, you know, there's some overlap, or maybe it's very similar, but it's not chiropractic. And I think that if they were limited from doing it, there's many physical therapists that do this in their practice on a regular daily basis that possibly wouldn't be allowed to do what they normally do.
But unequivocally, your position was that physical therapy does not include chiropractic.
Right.
I'm sorry, Madam Chair.
I think we're dealing with the semantics.
What you said was exactly right.
What the definition of chiropractic is, I think, is the question. Technique and discipline, and to the physical therapist in the room, I think you all need to figure out how to describe it in a way that makes sense, that will work for everybody involved. You do some very specific things. The chiropractors do specific things. It's really figuring out who can agree on some verbiage here. So I thank you for your time. I thank you for everyone being here. Obviously, an important issue to both disciplines and both professions. And I look forward to hearing back from you, actually. Sandy looks forward. With that, I'm going to close the public hearing on 2701, and we're adjourned.